Oh, Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, did not mean from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York. The John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 281st episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 280 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so that's John Mack 13 at gmail.com is the email with any question about the show, and www.johnmack13.com is the website. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. We have some great guests lined up beginning tonight. I hope you'll join me next week at the same time for my interview with the managing director of the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center in Sleepy Hollow, New York, novelist Krista Matston. There is always something going on at the Writers Center, talks, courses, workshops, open mic, etc. Go to writerscenter.org for the complete story. That's Writers Center, WRITERSCENTER.org. Before getting into tonight's conversation, some local Hudson Valley news. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 22nd year, at 6:30 p.m. at the Mahopac Library on 6 in Mahopac. More than 150 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also has a morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So July's meeting will be on Wednesday, July 17th at 10 a.m. at Coffee Time on Route 6N in the Red Mills section of Mahopac. There are also two poetry workshops in the area, one in Mahopac and one in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of the month at the Mahopac Library, and then the Yorktown one is on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hart Library in Trub Oak, New York. So I hope that you'll join us that one in July. The Mahopac workshop will meet July 10th, and the Yorktown one on July 23rd. The next open mic at the aforementioned Hudson Valley Writers Center in the Poughkeepsie Manor Train Station in Sleepy Hollow will be on Friday, July 19th at 7 p.m. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmaverick13@gmail.com. On Saturday, yesterday, I attended the Norwalk, Connecticut Arts Festival and read for 15 minutes. Others there included a number of previous guests on this show, Lauren Peterson, Ed Ahern, Jack Powers, and Vincent Bell. We were well represented, and Jerry Johnson, the organizer, did a wonderful job in putting it all together. Now, to this week's show, as mentioned, the 281st in a series. Tonight, I am joined by award-winning professor of history, writer, and poet, Peter Slater. I first met Peter at the Hudson Valley Writers Center, and he is now also a participating member of the Yorktown Poetry Workshop. The listeners wishing to join Peter and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold caller participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Good evening, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. It's an honor to be here.
Well, I wouldn't say it should be an honor, but would you start us off with the poem?
Yes. This is called One Snowy Morning. It's obviously very out of season, but it might come as a relief to the heat. I've read it at some open mics recently, and it's gotten a good reception. So, One Snowy Morning, here goes. Lost my innocence around age 3, found out that everything in the world has limits, hard limits, mean limits. Blamed the most beautiful of nature's stage sets, newly fallen snow. Finally old enough to be allowed into our fenced backyard to play by myself in the bright white stuff. Padded like it was an expedition to the South Pole, well equipped with small pail and shovel, Mom keeping a watchful eye from the kitchen window. This bright white stuff was terrifically workable, textures variable, soft here, crusty there. A little boy's paradise. Dig, 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 as relentless as a miner at his oar. Love most of the bright white stuff seemed bottomless, endless, must go deepest down to the center of the world and on to China. 8 inches in, maybe 10, the dig went suddenly wrong. Shock of my fledging life. Dirt on the shovel blade. Nasty and oozing. Gone the bright white stuff. Swear words needed, but not a one did I know. So cheating snow never made it to the center of the globe. Never got to Shanghai. Just surface, nothing further. Mere illusion, it's endless deep. A slick trick on a child. Like Adam and Eve in their paradise, I had seen beauty breaking bad and would thrill no more to a boundless world. A most essential life lesson, but its timing was off. What I would have given for another year, even better make it two, swaddled in oblivious bliss.
I like that very much, and of course, I heard it before, both at Hudson Valley and at the Poetry Workshop, but it doesn't lose anything in the repetition.
Thank you, John.
So, thank you very much. But where did you grow up and go to early school, Pina?
Well, I sort of grew up in two places. Initially, Astoria, Queens, the Queens, right by a block from the Triborough Bridge. It was a tough, gritty, lower middle class neighborhood. I was mugged twice by the time I was 10 by peers. And until almost the end of fifth grade, I went to PS 85, an old 3 or 4 story brick school building. It's still there on Dittmas Boulevard by the L. And then, like many families in the 50s, we moved out to suburbia, in this case, Oceanside, Long Island, South Shore, near Rockville Center, Baldwin, Long Beach. And I finished my grade school at Terrell Avenue, elementary school. Even the names are so different. Piers 85 with that institutional sound versus kind of leafy sounding Terrell Avenue Elementary School.
Yesterday at the Norwalk Festival, one of the readers was the Poet Laureate of Queens, and it was very interesting. I was very happy that there is a Poet Laureate of Queens. Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
I didn't really have them as a kid, other than very early on to be a fireman, policeman, pilot. When I was in high school and you had to do a paper on what you wanted to be to learn research methods, I picked biochemist. Not that I had any interest in it, but I figured I'd be the only one picking it.
Were you an early reader?
Yes. Yes.
So what about your high school years? Then where'd you go to high school?
I went to Oceanside High School. It was a mixed quality to teaching, but one teacher I remember to this day, and when we have reunions, which we do every 5 or 10 years, we talk about her. Her name was Miss Sullivan, and she taught English. And her senior year English class was famous. I remember her giving assignments like, write this essay. I don't know whether you could pick the subject, or she gave a subject, but it has to be 48 to 51 words, no fewer. No more. That taught you a lot of writing discipline. Or another assignment I still recall. Write this, or whatever length. Do not use more than 3 adjectives or adverbs. So it taught a lot of good writing skills and discipline.
Very good, particularly for journalism, where you're limited to a column size or whatever.
Right.
Did you write for a school paper or a literary journal?
Well, I did have some poems and short stories in a literary journal, but this is the 50s, and it was a big jock culture. If you wanted to be respected by guys and girls, you, in most cases, had to be athletic. So I spent a lot of time on teams. I was captain of the cross country and track team, and actually held the school record in the mile. And I was in the wrestling team as well. Yeah, so that took a lot of time and energy. But it made friendships, you know, some of them still last to this day.
That's interesting. My daughter had all of her high school records for Riverdale Country School in the middle and the longer distances. And then she was a marathon runner. And then after college, she was a marketing person for Madison Square Garden, the New York Times, and then she gave it all up to be a physical trainer. She's still a marathon runner, and she's in her late 40s, so it stayed with her. How about the poem?
Yeah, here's a poem that actually is based in an incident that happened in high school. It's much, much changed. It's called Two Slackers on National Honor Society Day. Came around every spring, Honor Society Day. Vincent River High, East Wing, the auditorium, back in the 1980s. 4 Center Rose Mark nominees, ablaze with bunting. A fine old hall, pungent from newly polished wood. The school's in-your-face motto, madly tautological, scrolling the proscenium arch. Winners don't lose, and losers don't win. Bobby Bailey, seated with the nominees, all sky-high anxious, waiting to see who will be among the envy chosen. George and I, classmates not in the running, not even close, hunkered in a side row, watching it go down. First-chance sophomore year, the one with longest odds, Bobby in best suit, a tad tight, especially in the wrong places, dweeb, coming up empty while a dozen schoolmates call to the stage one at a time, we're looming the principal. Pompously handed out each award, the prepared speech long and windy, poking from his suit jacket pocket, checking out the crowd. Bobby back in the bunted seats junior year. Better odds. The same suit. Too small everywhere. Dork. Once again, he's watching others get glory moment and fancy little pin. Last chance senior year. Best odds. Bobby finally in a new suit. It's baggy, loser. Once more waiting and waiting and waiting. Fist tight, then clapping light as girl on right, a 10, murmured, "Ay, Dios mío," and arose. Followed 2 minutes later, "An Eternity," by Girl on Left, a sophomore who's sprinting to the stage like it was some dopey TV show where you must get up there lickety-split or the prize gets yanked. The final award of the day it was. 3 strikes and you're out. And we were laughing, George and I, how we laughed at each of Bobby's flameouts. We laughed sophomore year, more junior year. The hardest senior year is Bobby's lips snarled silent curses. Just mean boys doing our thing. Yet miles down the road, kicking the teeth ourselves more than once as lives unfolded, ended up as nobler men. Not that Bobby was going to clap.
Once again, I'd also heard that, and I got a kick out of it every time. And what happened after high school?
I went to Cornell University and spent 4 of the most stressful and exciting and interesting and intense years of my life. I ran track and had some moments of success, but the facilities weren't what they are nowadays. We had to train outside in the winter in upstate New York weather. So everybody got injured, and plus as a middle distance runner, you were active 3 seasons a year. There was no off season. You ran cross country, you ran indoor track, you ran outdoor track. Looking back, sometimes I wish I had joined either the Cornell paper, the Daily Sun, or even better, there was a humor magazine, well respected, called The Widow, and I would have liked to have, you know, maybe in retrospect, have been a part of that. I changed my major. Go ahead. Sorry.
What was your major originally, and then what did you change?
Because of a pushy mother, I went as pre-med, but after about a month, I knew it wasn't for me. In zoology courses, in the lab practical, you had to look at slides of dissected frog muscle and say which was the striated muscle and which was the eye-straighted muscle, and to me it was like looking at a Jackson Pollock painting. I couldn't tell one from another. And then briefly, I was, maybe more than briefly, maybe a year, pre-law as an English major, and I had taken the SAT advanced placement in English and was in a very advanced course. But these people could see things in stories that I just couldn't see, the symbolism. There'd be a barren tree in a story, and they say the barren tree is the late mother-in-law or the barren marriage. And to me, it was a tree. And I kind of decided I need something maybe a little more empirically and factually based. And I was in a history course, and it sort of came to me, hey, this is what I want to do. I want to be up on that platform lecturing about history. So sophomore year, I changed my major for the third and last time to history.
Yeah, I started as a philosophy major, and then I saw there weren't many jobs in New York Times for philosophers. And then I went to English and eventually to law school, but I got saved from all of it by a career in technology that I was extremely lucky for. You mentioned the weather in Cornell. I remember my next door neighbor's daughter went to law school there, and the law school contained the classrooms and the cafeteria and the dorm for the law students. So during the winter, they never had to go out of the building. I don't know what the undergraduate facilities were like that, but it was interesting. We also got Barbara and I did some consulting up there, and we got exposed to that suicide bridge that scared the hell out of me when I heard people talk about kids going off this bridge.
Suspension bridge. I think they have some time ago put up barriers. I don't know whether it's some kind of netting or something to try to prevent that. Cornell is a very beautiful campus, very large, and you spend a lot of time walking. Now they have intra-campus transportation, I guess little jitneys that run all over, but they didn't have that in my time. And when I was a fraternity sophomore year, later senior year, when I had an apartment, at the very edge of campus. It might have been a mile, 2 miles down to the central quad in the classrooms. Yeah, it was healthy.
You said when you saw the teacher up there, and you said, I want to do that. So when you went to history, did you at the same time decide to pursue an academic life in college teaching?
It's sort of like jobs for philosophers. I mean, there are probably more history jobs outside of academia than there are philosophy jobs. I mean, some big corporations have historians, not-for-profits have historians. There's certainly a lot of historians working for the government, for the Atomic Energy Commission or whatever. But most historians become high school teachers, college teachers, university teachers. So, yes, I mean, it would mean I would have to go on to graduate school and get a master's or better a PhD.
So what did you do after college then?
Well, I had a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship, which is one of the more prestigious fellowships, and I really wanted to go out to California, but the best thing that ever happened to me is senior year I met my wife-to-be in the dorm. My sister was 3 years behind me, was also a Cornell. Later, my brother would be a very Cornell family, and my sister introduced us. We had just met, and I was falling in love, and I didn't want to put 3,000 miles. She was going to MIT to study economics. So I went to Brown University, where I got my master's, and then we got married, and we transferred out to University of California, Berkeley, together.
And what did you do at Berkeley? Were you going to grad school? Were you teaching, or what were you doing out there?
No. Well, I got my PhD eventually, and I did I was a teaching assistant, fellowship, and then I was an instructor, kind of part-time instructor. The most notable thing, they were terrific professors, and I had a very distinguished mentor. This was Berkeley in the 60s, which is still famous or notorious in some circles. But to some people, when I tell them I was at Berkeley in the 60s, it's like somebody when I was growing up saying I was in the Left Bank of Paris in the 20s.
Sure.
It was the epicenter of so much of the Cultural Revolution. I was in, if you remember, the Free Speech Movement.
Sure.
If you recall that, I was actually in a terrace in a student union overlooking an area where the students had surrounded a police car because an activist, the guy who coined the phrase "Don't trust anybody over 30," he was being arrested, and students had surrounded a car so it couldn't drive off. So it was a time of great ferment, and there were protest marches, and it was a very, very exciting place to be.
Now, you said that your wife went to MIT. What was her field of study?
Vicky was in economics, but she dropped out from it. It was too abstract. Years later, she got a master's in guidance and counseling and was a guidance counselor. Both at Mercy College and then later for the Archdiocese as a drug prevention counselor.
And how long were you in California then, at Berkeley?
63 to 68. Those years, and I took a full-time position before I completed my PhD, so the first couple of years and my new full-time job was tough because I was both writing lectures like crazy and completing my dissertation.
But what was the subject of your dissertation?
It was about Puritan ideas about child rearing. Kind of dry subject, but eventually it became a book called Children in the New England Mind.
It's
about it's intellectual history, so it doesn't go into things like how children were fed or toilet trained. It's more, for example, the Puritans believed in original sin. And it's a big question among historians, if they thought children were depraved, how could they love children? So I actually spent a lot of time reading psychology and so on, and there was a bit of psychohistory in it. But also things like, are children born a tabula rasa, as John Locke had said, or are they born depraved, and other kind, or as the Romantics would later believe, children were born good, and so on. So I explored all those ideas at some length.
And well, there's the overall thing about environment versus genetics. Did you get into any of that too?
Well, not by those terms. There was a bit of nature versus nurture, as they would have called it, in the 17th, 18th century. The term genetics did not exist, obviously. It's way
right
before Mendel. But nature versus nurture. You know, how much the Puritan, how much is inborn, and how much comes from parents and society. But the Puritans wrestled with it. Anne Bradstreet, who I'm sure you know, one of our earliest poets, she wrote a line about children saying, you know, a serpent's tongue in pleasing face lay hid. And that was the dualism of the Puritans. Children were lovely, you know, beautiful, but yet in some ways they were born evil until they were, received grace.
And it's interesting how, because some people, so many of the societies like that, they hold their group tremendously, but as always, you always hear of the ones that break out for it. There's the fellow in the Mahopac Writers Group who grew up as a Jehovah Witness, and it was very difficult for his family to accept the fact that he left and he became other things, you know. It must be very difficult for a child to break out of a family like that.
Yeah, so. The Puritans weren't that closed-minded. There's a common tendency to see Puritans almost a cult group or something. They weren't like that. They're quite into science. Cotton Mather, one of the more notorious of the Puritans for his role in the witchcraft, but he was a member of the famous Royal Society of England, like Isaac Newton was. And actually, it's been argued that the Puritan view of children is closer in some ways to the modern view than the Romantic view, where children came trailing goodness from heaven and the mean old earth would take it away from them. Because, you know, if you believe in any of Freud's interpretation about children and their various lusts and everything, in different language, that's not so far off from the Puritan conception.
Yeah, and how long did you stay in California?
I was there from 63 to 68.
And then what did you do?
I got a teaching position at Dartmouth College up in Hanover, New Hampshire.
So you went from the almost warm weather.
You know the line of Mark Twain, the coldest summer you ever had, the coldest winter you ever had was a summer in San Francisco. It was very temperate climate, but never hot. But yeah, to the snows in New Hampshire. This is well before global warming at least was having a big impact.
My son's in the Bay Area, and it was in the 90s, the last week or week before, and it was very unseasonal there. In San Francisco, it's the warmest time is normally during September and October. And I couldn't believe it when I was out there on business in the late 70s. We went to lunch with the wife of a friend of mine who was a high school buddy who was in Saudi Arabia then. And the fellow I was with went with his wife's college roommate. So they're sitting there, and the two women say, one woman says to the other, "What's the weather like in your neighborhood?" And I never heard anything like that. I said, "In your neighborhood?" And because of the hills, it's very different from one part of the city to another. I was amazed by that.
And microclimates.
Right. So what were you doing at Dartmouth? What were you teaching? And what
Well,
were you...
history. The other area I worked on, and very different, I've always loved The Great Gatsby. It's my favorite book. I can almost quote it by heart. And I had a senior seminar on the 1920s, which we read that book, among others. It was so popular, there was a waiting list. Because it was limited
to 16,
18 people, whatever, a seminar. And then people would have to sign up months in advance. But out of that seminar and out of a group that I helped form at Dartmouth American Studies group, I wrote an article in the 70s called Ethnicity in the Great Gatsby, and it's about the narrator Nick's perception of the racial and ethnic background of the various characters. That is, I'm not going to say viral on the internet, not quite, but it's all over the internet. Something called JSTOR, which is a warehouse for academic journals, that's among their 10 most cited articles, and eighth grade kids copy from it and then post their paper online. It's sort of funny to see your name on that. So that article is it's quite a few years old, but it has staying power.
So you were also in that course, you were marrying both English and, it's not like some sociology, and history all into one package.
It wasn't really sociological. It was literary studies. It was a broad range from the 17th and 18th centuries to the 20th century.
Then how long were you at Dartmouth?
9 years. I left for a couple of reasons. I was a little late in getting a book published, my book on the Puritans. But also, my wife wasn't happy there. She had dropped out of Berkeley graduate school and really wanted to study in completely different areas, which wasn't available in Hanover. And Hanover is in the middle of nowhere. This is the 1970s. There's no internet. There's no online courses. And she really wanted to move to an area where there'd be more educational opportunities for her. And I wanted to go into administration. I wanted to stay teaching, but also try my hand. I had a little taste of it on committees, and I kind of felt I had a certain skill at it. So in 1977, came down to this area, to Mercy College, and was there for 28 years.
And we they said you wanted to try administration, be both teaching and administration?
Yeah, my initial position was as a department chair. Now, at some schools, department chair is almost honorary, but at Mercy, at least in those days, it was more like a dean. I had responsibility for staffing faculty at the main campus in Dobbs Ferry, at a number of branch campuses, including one in our neck of the woods in Yorktown, in the Bronx, later on in Manhattan. There was one for a while in the Coors County Shopping Center in Yonkers, and in White Plains as well. And at prisons, Mercy had a very robust prison program all over the state, because at that time the federal government paid tuition for inmates to go to school. So I've been in Sing Sing as a visitor, checking on the program. We did women's prisons as well. I also, with a department committee, hired faculty, in some cases dismissed faculty. So it was really a heavy-duty administrative job.
And were you also teaching?
Go ahead. Yes. Yes. I loved teaching at Mercy. Mercy had a great mix of students. It was diverse in terms of race and ethnicity. But the ages, you had, kids just out of high school at 17, you had adults at 30, 40, and 50. And that made a good mix. I mean, the older students brought things that the younger students couldn't know. Almost all the students at Dartmouth were bright, but they're 18, 19, 20-year-old bright. And there's some things that any 30-year-old knows that an 18-year-old is yet to learn. The people have been in life, they married, divorced, had jobs, lost jobs, dealt with power. They understand a little better than most 18, 19-year-olds how the world really works.
Yeah, I had a couple of things, both when you mentioned how teaching works. For a while, I was the full-time professor at Monroe College, and we had three campuses, one in the Bronx, one in New Rochelle, where it still is, and one in St. Lucia. And they're all different, and I taught mainly at the one in the Bronx, and they were technology courses, and it was a population 99% minorities who had come through New York City high schools, who had done extremely well. Some went to Bronx Science, some went to other places, but they came from neighborhoods that did not push education, and they or from families, and they went out to work, but then they were bright enough to realize, hey, this isn't going to work out, and they came back to school, and it was so different than younger students that I had taught at Marist and at NYU and that, where it was never, is that going to be on the test? It was like push. It was like tell me more. And they also had been failed in a lot of ways by the public schools, in that they got pushed through for writing, and there were very bright students who didn't write sentences with subject and verbs, or they'd use neighborhood language. So I'd walk through the halls, and I'd hear some students say, "I don't have no," and I'd say, don't have any, and they'd immediately say thank you. It was so different than others. Now, as far as the prison program, I was involved in doing some consulting for the president, the Marist College, when I was teaching there, at this maximum security prison, which is, I forget where it is. It's in Dutchess County, and there was a program there, and it was funded, and there were some very bright students there, and it was a scary place to be in. Sing Sing probably was, because there were all these different doors, and they wouldn't open the one in front of you until they closed the one behind you, and you always had that feeling as though maybe they're going to forget about me, you know. but then all of a sudden, the funding dried up. And I remember that there was on the floor of Congress, there was a fellow from Louisiana saying, you know, in my jurisdiction, I have a hardworking farmer who can't qualify for federal aid because he makes just a little too much money, but we're giving money to these rapists and these murderers to go to school. Well, A, when they took away the money, they didn't give it to the farmer. And B, the administration of the maximum security prison, they didn't want it taken away because these kept these people busy. And if they misbehaved, they pulled them out of there and they shipped them up to the Canadian border and to a prison up there. And they couldn't go to school. And all of a sudden, they were taking away some incentive. It was a very bad rap. Now, I believe they continued the community college. I think that Dutchess County Community College kept working there, and they could get associate degrees, but they couldn't go beyond that.
Mercy does offer a four-year program in a few, not like it did before, but a few selected prisons based on donated funds. They have to keep going. But studies have shown it's cost-effective. The recidivism rate of people who have gotten degrees is significantly lower than those who haven't. So, I mean, it does pay for society to invest in this.
I asked the president of Marist that, you know, so what do these people do beyond that? Do they stay out of trouble? He said, well, they tend not to join the alumni associations. They have a hard time finding it.
I should mention while we're talking about college, my most intense classes were at the Yorktown campus, which is on Strang Boulevard,
right,
in the evening, which would be older. And particularly in the early 80s, I started teaching a course in America and the Vietnam War. And we weren't out of it that long, and the feelings were still intense. And most classes had veterans in it. So there'd be interesting, heated debates. I remember one summer class, the debates of the Scott, should we have been in the war? Should we not have been in the war? Could we have won the war? Was it impossible? It continued outside after class ended at some like 9:30 or 10 at night, went on for another half hour in the parking lot. I just stood back and let it run. Students were invited. We had to limit the number, but they would bring guests to class, friends or relatives who had served in Vietnam, some grievously wounded, some bitter, some not that bitter, but all things from grunts to officers. And in one special time, five patients came from the Montrose Veterans Hospital. That a group or a student who had some kind of contact there arranged for them to come. They're very fragile, and whereas most visitors, questions would come from all over, these questions had to be screened, and only the group that brought them could ask. Unfortunately, one of those who came later committed suicide at the Langdon Park, the Vietnam Memorial.
It's very interesting. The fellow that's been the founder and the coordinator of the Mohopec Writers Group, Vinny D'Aquino, also volunteers as the writing consultant to a veterans group in Putnam County, and there was a and there came out of the fellow in Iraq who was a celebrity for a very short time that he rescued an infant that was in the middle of the fire zone that was sitting in the middle of a road, and he pulled him out. And he was on television and everything. And then he came back to Long Island, and he fell into addiction. He went committing suicide. And they founded this out called the Vet to Vet, the Joseph E. Dwyer Vet to Vet program. And the whole idea of it is a place for people to get together that are veterans who can share their experiences. And they're not it's not find a job, and it's not a psychological thing. It's just to be a place with your peers. And now there's groups all over, and the one in Putnam County has every year they have around Veterans Day. They have three weekends in Brewster at this place where they have one. They have the veterans art. And another, they have veterans music, and then another one, they have veterans writing. And I've read there, even though I'm serving any conflicts. And it's amazing, some of these people, they get up and they let you into. There was a woman who obviously had some problems with a physical or whatever, and she gets up and she reads, and it's very interesting how they need something that the average person doesn't understand. You know, it's
right. It's definitely.
Now, have you stayed close to Mercy? Do you know what's going on with them?
Well, I had a whole second career at Mercy. This is where writing really changed my life. After 12 years as department chair, I'd gone back to faculty. But Mercy had a major, major accreditation report due. And I was in a committee, but the head of the committee who was responsible, the lead writer, was over his head and had writer's block. And a new provost had come, Carol Moore, and I was writing the academic chapter. I had two drafts done, and he hadn't written a thing. So we're way behind the game because this is the Middle States Commission on Higher Education. All the schools in this area would be accredited by him. And she asked me to leave the faculty for a year, leave teaching, and become the special assistant to provost and the lead writer. So my writing skills definitely made a difference, and I went in and I worked intensively, and we got the draft done, and we got reaccredited. And I kind of liked being in full-time administration at that point, and an opening came up to be the dean of Mercy's White Plains campus, which was in Martin Avenue and South Broadway. So I applied and went through the interviewing process and got that, and I was briefly the dean of the Yorktown campus, but that was just interim. But I was the dean of the White Plains campus, for 9 years. And that was an interesting time. The president wanted the deans to be active in local community. I was a member of Rotary, particularly in a committee that helped give scholarships to high school students. We had fairly lucrative scholarships for 1 year. And I wrote a column for the White Plains Watch, which is no longer in existence, but it was a monthly newspaper. It was called Highwire, and I could write anything I wanted. I wrote in my travels. I wrote in the Yankees. I wrote about 9/11. But that was very helpful in any last traces of academic jargon that I had in my writing were totally purged when you're writing a column for a general audience. I wrote about jazz, which is one of my favorite subjects. So that was a very good learning experience. Also, I had a chance, I convinced the president to take over a brew pub that had gone out of business in the floors beneath us, and we built a $1 million center for the digital arts.
Where is that?
Well, so they closed the White Plains campus, unfortunately, about 4 or 5 years ago. But for a while, we had stayed. I founded a program, even though it's not my expertise, in computer arts and design. I work with a very good consultant, and that's been moved to Dobbs Ferry campus, along with the music sound engineering program that were part of the Center for Digital Arts.
I've done some things at the Westchester Digital Center in Peekskill, and they've got some amazing program there.
Okay, and that's where the inspiration came from. I actually went and visited and met the professor who at that time ran it.
Yeah. You also, as you talk about writing, you mentioned in the note to me that you published, in addition to your scholarship, short stories, poetry, and parody. To my understanding, that's somewhat unusual for an academic historian. What took you in that direction, and how in an academic publish or perish world were you able to have the time to explore these other things?
Well, I'm probably a failed novelist in a way. I always liked to write and was fairly imaginative and had I have a good ear, and I can hear the rhythm of the words, the rhythm of the sentence. In third grade or something, a teacher wrote wrongly, it turned out, but, you know, I look forward to reading your first novel in 20 years. So I always dabbled a bit in it. My first short story was actually published in the early 80s, but I didn't have time to pursue it in any heavy, serious way till I retired.
Since we got back to your writing for a minute, would you give us another poem?
Sure. This is particularly for senior citizens like myself, and particularly for people who live alone like myself, and particularly for people who have cats like myself. It's called "And I Can't Get Up." Accidents on spooling, they say, are like watching yourself in a movie. They're so wrong, you're not watching anything. You are the movie. One moment, blithely walking shoeless down my hallway. The next, hard crashing to the floor, splayed out like a Skid Row drunk. Once again, ankle tackled by a lurking 20-pound cat with the slam of an all-pro linebacker. A hell of a hit on a senior citizen. Behemoth now racing up down hallway. Although there's no one he can show off to, alone we dwell. Besides, such excessive exuberance should be flagged for unsportsmanlike conduct.
Mm-hmm.
Taking stock, I am not a movie anymore, but an ad. An ad that is everywhere. Help, help, help. I've fallen and I can't get up. Must press the button, must press the button, must press the button. To alert all EMS responders within 500 miles. I was actually looking at this ad with its borderline hysteria in today's junk mail. Even considered, now for the first time, getting the little Mayday gizmo as my daughter's pester. It would be nice to have it at hand since this spill is the worst yet. Can't seem to move much. Probably broke both legs, pelvis, back, collarbone, and one arm, plus concussion. LOL, laughing out loud. Adding to the farce, a sandpaper tongue wetting my face. Is Behemoth remorseful, frightened, calculating? Last one, best guess. How long is figuring one supersized food bowl and kitchen floor bottoms out? Can his menu feature the special Homo sapiens tartare? Behemoth was only a dog, a brainy one like Lassie. My iPhone could be fetched. Probably needs charging. Lassie would know how. Something in Reed would help, since I may be lying here a while. First Kafka, then Poe. The smart dog, I don't have to bring the book from the den, third shelf on the right. Think, think, think. Little practice of late and groggy, but was high school salutatorian. Sure, some reserved gray matter which can be fracked. Is the red Sharpie still in Pan's pocket? Perfect for writing an SOS note. On what? One of your Nike socks, stupid? Or better, both? Same message in each? Two separate messages? Or part one, part two? And the next step, genius? Behemoth open a window and lob socks to a passerby? Only if we're a real movie. Aren't the plan B the Hail Mary pass? Use good arm to throw Sharpie at the hardwired fire and smoke alarm in the ceiling. Set it off and the monitoring station springs into action. Sharpie pull with considerable effort from pocket. Let it drop to the floor while I rest a sec. Swirling fur. Linebacker Behemoth racing for the fumble. Behold now Behemoth batting the pen down, down, down the hallway and into the den, where Kafka will nod to Poe and smile. Don't have a plan C at this moment, but I'm sure to come up with something after the little nap I must take.
Yeah, we've had cats for years. Now we have Pasuka Cherry, but we have two adult cats. Well, one of them was fairly young, and we brought in our rescue kitten, who may be blind, but it's I'm taking it to an ophthalmologist tomorrow. But they're terrific.
Did you have a trip over
good
them?
Huh?
Have you or Barbara ever tripped over them?
Almost, but not really. There's one black one who stays at the bottom of the stairs when you're going downstairs, and if you don't look properly, you can trip over. So, well, that's part of the challenge, I guess. Since you retired from teaching, have you continued academic research and writing in that sphere?
No. I should just add one note. I took a retirement package from Mercy, and I thought I was going to be retired, but 3 months later came an offer I couldn't refuse, and I worked for another 9 years as a provost vice president for academic affairs at a two-year college in Manhattan, commuting out of Croton and two subways. So it was a 3 to 3.5 hour commute each way. Again, looking back, I probably should have stopped a little bit earlier, but I was provost vice president of academic affairs of a storied college. It's not well known as TCI College, but it had a glory days earlier. It was founded by Marconi, who young people don't know the name, but most people of my generation will, who the father of radio and a Nobel Prize winner. In fact, the only college in the United States, as far as I know, founded by a Nobel Prize winner. And his protege who ran the college was David Sarnoff, who would on to form
RCA.
And RCA, which was once one of the great companies, and NBC.
Right.
And in his old age, Sarnoff would come unannounced back to the college where it all started and walk the halls on like a Friday afternoon unannounced. For the 100th anniversary, I actually did a little producing and script writing. We put on a documentary, which I was told was PBS quality. There was a big banquet in a banquet hall off Times Square, and we put on a half-hour documentary. There were people who had done indie film among the faculty, and they knew how to put it together and went to a professional production company. But I found, thanks to the Internet, Marconi's granddaughter and Sarnoff's great-granddaughter, and they came and received, honorary degrees in behalf of their distinguished ancestors.
So what was the focus of the college?
It was a technical college.
Okay.
We trained a lot of the HVAC technicians in the metropolitan area, facilities managers. We had the highest passing rate of ophthalmic dispensing. Even in Westchester today, there's a lot of older generation of people working in opticians' offices, with eyeglasses who would have been trained there.
And Then after you left, did it continue to expand, or did it?
No, unfortunately, it was a for-profit college.
Okay.
But not one of the notorious ones. But the administration did make some mistakes, and the Obama administration passed a number of financial aid restrictions that made it harder. It used to be that if you didn't have a high school diploma but passed a federal test, you could go to college and get federal financial aid, Pell, as well as New York State TAP. And that was a lifeline for many students who had to drop out of high school for various reasons. Then Congress or the Obama administration said no. I'm not sure whether it was an executive order. I think Congress had to pass it. If you don't have a high school degree or a GED, you cannot get federal financial aid. So that was.
And what was the famous one in Queens that was that had all the problems? Because when I was at Monroe, Monroe's a for-profit school too, but I knew a lot about what was going on, and I had real confidence in the administration at Monroe. But there was a school in Queens that was the heart of the taking money and not giving a return to the students.
Really? Yeah, I'm not sure. There were a number of them throughout the country. I'm not sure anybody went to jail, but certainly there were fines and things like that. I mean, TCI didn't have those issues per se. And it probably
did. While I was at Monroe, I was able to place about 110 students with IBM alone all over the country.
Wow.
And
that's impressive.
Yeah, it worked out very nicely. Now, it's interesting because they're. New Rochelle campus is a traditional campus that it has people coming out of high school, and many of them though come from foreign countries, from India and from Africa and from other places. So it's an interesting mix of the differences. And in St. Lucia, it's the natives there. The St. Lucians asked them to do consulting first with the. But the police there, because they had a very good criminal justice program, and then they asked them to start a college there, so they wound up with. And some of the people that I worked with, they actually went down there for a semester.
I was going to ask them to teach there, like in January.
they went down. How do you keep the writing and your various interests and poetry going on? At the same time, and how do you allocate your time if you do?
Between fiction and poetry, or it would be fiction, poetry, and everything else. I usually try to write in the mornings, for a couple of hours every day, except maybe Sunday, to keep that going. Poems are shorter than fiction. I'm finishing up a 10,000 word fiction piece. It's called a novelette. It's like almost 30 pages, so that takes months and months to write. Poems can take a long time too, but sometimes an idea just comes to you and you dash it off, and there it is in an hour or two. You revise it, obviously, but the main thing's down right away.
Yeah, I have an novella in a book that's. The theme is about my old neighborhood, so it's a couple of poems and some short stories, and it's an essay, and it's a novella called it's the Inwood book. The novella is offering it up because that was the big thing in the Catholic school, that that if you had a problem, offer it up and just work through it. That's all. So, what triggers your subject matter?
It's weird. A phrase came to my mind, a title of a poem, Bad Backs and Bad Marriages. I didn't have either, but I liked the title. It was such an unusual juxtaposition, and I'm working on a poem filling that out. So usually you get the subject matter and you worry about the title later. This time the title came to me first.
Yeah, Yeah, that's, and some people say they don't even put titles on. They like Emily Dickinson, and I think that in some cases, titles are very important. I know that at the last Yorktown Writers Group, when Jim Casey read his poem about a year after his heart attack, the Linda, who didn't know anything about his heart attack, was the only one that got it right away, and people like Terry and Barbara and I that did know about his heart attack didn't get it, and we all said that there was no context. The next night at the Mahopac Writers Group, he put the title on it that tied it into his heart attack. And it was a completely different poem, and everybody got it, you know. So
titles are important. They're the initial cue to the reader about what's coming.
What's next for you?
In terms of?
Anything.
I want to keep on writing. I'm a member of three writers' circles. You mentioned two of them, your wonderful poetry workshop on Wednesday nights. And as you know, I read often and the Friday night open mic at Hudson Valley, and I've attended a couple of workshops there, which are very helpful. In addition, once a month, the second Saturday at Tarrytown Warner Library, I'm a member of a group called the Writers Forum, which is both fiction and poetry.
So go ahead, keep going.
Yeah, it's very intense, unlike a lot of writers' things where people just come, sign up, and read. This one, the schedule is laid out months and months in advance. I think the schedule is done through maybe October. Four or five people will present. They have to send out their pieces a week or two in advance. I've already gotten two of them for July 13th. And you come with a written critique. I usually type mine, printed, because of all those years as a professor. Most people do a handwritten, not everybody. And you read the critique and discuss it and give it to the person at the end. So it's two-plus hours, but extremely intense. It's like a graduate seminar.
Yeah, that's very interesting, and it might be worth doing that with individual poems at some of the workshops. Maybe just one poem, and people come prepared after reading it between the workshops.
You could do it. It takes some organization, though, you know, to set up the agenda and to keep it in place.
Yeah. We've touched a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about you?
Well, I'm a widower. My wife of 50-plus years died suddenly and unexpectedly back in 2015. And I'm still running up to 4 miles outdoors, not fast, not gracefully like it once was, but I still get out there and do it. And when people ask, how's your running going, I tell them a famous story. Dr. Johnson, who is an 18th century wit, and I think he wrote one of the first dictionaries, he was asked about a talking dog trick that he saw, and he said, it's not that it was done well, it's that it was done at all. That's what my running is about. So I try to keep fit.
Did you do any 10Ks or anything?
Any what?
Any 10Ks? Did you do any competition, even if you don't care about
the last one I ran in was about 4 or 5 years ago at Mercy on the Aqueduct, and I didn't realize it was a trail with all kind of rocks buried in it, and I don't have the balance, and I fell flat on my face at one point. Luckily, I didn't get hurt, skinned a few things, but I don't do competition anymore. Those days are past. Though I did run in Westchester in the 70s and early 80s, a lot of masters competition at Mohansic Lake Park and other venues.
Yeah, my daughter ran in the Howard Chapin one down in Croton. There was a 10K that she won while she was...
I know about that one.
Yeah, she won the woman's end when she was still a high school student.
Oh, wow, that's terrific.
Yeah, she was good.
My best showing was Austin used to have a half marathon a tough okay. one. You at one point you came from Route 9, which is sea level all the way up into the hills, and I just turned 40, and I finished third in my age category and got a nice trophy.
Oh, terrific.
But I've never run a marathon.
She did, and she also won the Bronx Mini Marathon when she was in college, from the woman's end. Have you stayed close to Mercy at all? Do you know what's going on with them taking over the CNR students and everything?
Yeah, I'm on my base emails. I have lifetime legacy Mercy email, I have lunch with one or two people, and the president very graciously has a reception for long-term retired faculty at his house near the Mercy campus once a year. So I meet people I'd worked with from 10, 20, 30 years ago with those things.
Well, would you take us off with another poem?
Yeah, the last one is my first published poem. It's called Shipwreck. If a long and good marriage is like a stately ship, the one I was on went down quickly, taking half the crew. Cancer, said the doctor, squinting at my spouse's MRI. Right lung, terminal. Mine was what I heard, starboard. Catastrophe. The ship immediately began to list, every day a few degrees more, sinking in a month. Search fore and aft, but found no lifeboat to carry me to a safe shore. I cling to scraps of the wreckage now, in unknown waters adrift.
Wow. How long was the time between the diagnosis?
She had lung cancer. She'd been a smoker, but she'd quit for over 20 years, and they said it's like you hadn't smoked. May or may not have been the case. There's people who die of lung cancer who never smoked at all. But
but it's more than that. I mean, I know people that hadn't smoked for 18 years and had lung cancer.
Yeah.
I haven't had a cigarette in 39 years, and Barbara and I were both diagnosed last year as emphysema, and it's attributed directly to smoking. And the problem is that supposedly the lungs clear after 7 years, but any damage that was originally done is done, you know, and you eventually pay the piper, unfortunately.
Right. Well, she had a bad cough. Did you see Breaking Bad?
No, I did not.
Okay, well, it's like the main character. He was developing lung cancer, and he became a meth dealer to provide money for his family after he was gone. She had a cough like that. I didn't see it after she passed. But which a local doctor, whose name I won't mention, misdiagnosed as a cold. And by the time from the time she had the MRI to her death was only about 3 weeks. It was an extremely aggressive cancer. She was at Phelps. They did everything they could. The Sloan Kettering part gave her a lot of radiation to try to at least give her a little more time. But in the end, nothing helped.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. And we all tend to be sorry for these things, but we can't do much about them.
No.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's been you had talked about reading. You just did, yeah. And that's what started me going on this. It unbalanced me for the moment. Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on, John. Thank you.
Send any comments to me about the show to johnmactarteam@gmail.com, and be sure to join us at the same time next week with Managing Director of the Hudson Valley Writers Center, Kristen Mattson. And now, in the words of Mets very known to Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book. Until next time, as I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Amazon, play Peaceful Easy Feeling.
Playing Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library on Amazon Music.
against your skin so brown. And I want to sleep with you in the desert tonight, with a billion stars all around. 'Cause I got a peaceful, easy feeling, and I know you won't let me
Thank you again, Peter, and good night, everybody. Good night, Peter.
Good night, John.